I'm Henry Lin, and welcome to a special edition of Better World. Better World is an exploration of badass people who are doing really cool things. The more we know about this world, the better we can do in changing it. I'm in Washington, D.C. today, about to discuss regenerative farming with one of the original gangsters in the space, the OG himself, Mitch Ruta, president of Farm Journal. Mitch, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. I am the president of Trust in Food, which is a piece of Farm Journal.
Oh, there he is.
And I served as chief revenue officer of Farm Journal.
And please tell us a little bit about the oldest media company. It is in America, right?
I don't know if we're the oldest media company in America, but certainly the oldest media company in farming. We have been around for 145 years and are iconic in farming, probably the...
I was told on the way in, before there was the New York Times, there was Farm Journal. So you guys have about 100 years in the space, and you have been documenting and covering what? Farm practices?
So our audience is, we are the largest media company that serves farmers nationwide. We cover every piece of farming, so livestock, row crops, fruits and vegetables, milk, beef, pork, all of it. And we do it through 10 different magazines, through daily radio and TV across the nation. We syndicate a morning news show called Ag Day that's on hundreds of channels nationwide.
Literally the NPR of farming. Here it is.
Literally the NPR of farming. That's right.
Regenerative farming is a topic that we've covered extensively here on Better World. 90% of, I believe it is 90% of the earth soil. No, wait. It was 60% of the earth soil is already unusable. And by 2060, we will be all out of soil, I believe was the stat.
The stat that I'm always focused on is that there is no more arable land, that all right. the land that can be used to grow food is already being used. There's right. no additional land available. And in fact, acres go out of agriculture and into housing, at least in this country, on a regular basis.
Right. So whether or not you fall on the side of the fence that it's Big Ag's fault, and that we are destroying soil 10 times faster than we can produce it, or you're on the side of the fence that there are just too many humans on the planet, we have a small problem on our hands.
That's correct. Although this problem has been consistently met. So we have used up most of our arable land 50 years ago when the population of the planet was significantly less than it is today.
Right.
And so, you know, there was 5 billion people, and they said, how are we going to feed 7? There's 7 today, and in 2050, there'll be 9.5. And the industry is very focused on how do we produce 9.5 billion people's worth of food right. in the same amount of ground.
Right. And are you thinking at Farm Journal / Trust in Food about some of the alternative practices? I've seen vertical farming. I've seen underground farming. People are growing food hydroponically in containers. What are some of the solutions you think to this large problem? Can you take us through sort of the high level of that universe?
Yeah. So you can look in two different directions. One is what we could call non-traditional, and the other is traditional. And among the non-traditional that I think are the most promising is indoor farming.
Right.
So I think we'll see already Kmarts are being converted into indoor grow spaces. And
that's
big
wild.
Pieces, the largest tomato producer in the country is an indoor tomato producer. And there's hemp, as you know, is right. being produced largely indoors. And there's big investment going into the space to build indoors, to grow indoors. It's obviously controlled. It uses less water. It's completely regulated. It has higher production.
Right. Less susceptible to climate change.
Less susceptible to climate change, all of that.
Right.
On the conventional side, the vast majority of food is produced outdoors, and that probably will continue. And so the question is, how do we do that and save soil, save water, and water both quantity and quality, and change farming practices using different inputs, what we call in farming inputs, which is basically every chemical and seed you
right.
put in the ground. And there's I think you were, I kind of wanted to talk about a dramatic change that's happening, I think, in farming, just like every industry. If you're in the car industry, right, most of your time is being spent on how do I make a car that uses less fuel. That's right. That's the win in the long-term future. And so
more fully sustainable. Right.
And so agriculture, farmers will tell you, and I will support and defend them, that they are good conservers of land, that they have a long-term conservation outlook. They hold land for generations.
Yes.
So they are certainly concerned about the value of the soil for 50 years or hundreds of years.
Well, take us back to the soil. Tell us a little bit about the problem as it arose and why the soil is degrading. Is it the chemical companies? Is it big ag? Is it monocropping? What are some of the challenges that have led to this place that we're at now?
Well, so first of all, soil health is the primary driver of sustainability. Starting in the same place you're starting.
Right.
That's what matters most.
Largest sequester of carbon, you mean by that?
No. It has to do with everything. It has to do with water quality, too.
Uh-huh.
So if I think about what is farming's biggest, I don't know if negative is the right word, but what's the biggest challenge that farming is trying to solve as it thinks about how do we be more resilient? The first one is water. Farming is often a big polluter.
Yes.
And the primary bit of that pollution is nutrients that run off of farms and go into water. And it affects the Mississippi River, it affects Chesapeake Bay, it affects the Great Lakes, yeah, it affects the Gulf of Mexico. And a large portion of the degradation of waterways like the Gulf of Mexico is related to farm runoff. That runoff is costing farmers money. It basically means they took nutrients that they had to buy from some company and threw it in the water.
Right.
And they didn't, any nutrients that made its way into the water didn't help the corn grow. Mm-hmm. So soil is what keeps the nutrients in the water. If the soil doesn't have proper qualities, it becomes too porous. You put nutrients in the soil and it runs right into the water.
Right.
So the density of the soil, the quality of the soil, and the way that you, how you make sure that it doesn't erode is completely related to water quality. And when I think about the number one fix that agriculture is being asked to address, it has to do with water. But the fix to water is the fix to soil.
Right. Okay. So the soil is affected not only by the nutrients, fertilizers, chemicals that farmers use, it's affected in some capacity by the practices. Can you speak to us a little bit about the practices?
Sure. It's hard to know where to even begin. The USDA has a piece of the USDA that is completely related to natural resource conservation. It's called the Natural Resource Conservation Service, and it is it spends a lot of money trying to drive change in agriculture and incent behaviors that will conserve farmland.
Right.
As you know, the USDA, what's now the Natural Resource Conservation Service, started in the 30s in the Dust Bowl. The antecedents of it was then. Whatever soil problems we have today, they are nothing compared to what happened in the Dust Bowl. And when you had dust really coming from Kansas, blackening the sky in Washington, D.C. It's a true fact.
Wow.
True fact. And so that was, farmers came in, they took grass off of the plains, they grew cash crops, and then in the fallow season, all the dust, all the soil eroded. And, you know, you have, it looks like snowdrifts 6 feet high with fence posts completely buried in soil.
Right.
So the USDA took that on as their mission, started a big piece of the organization dedicated to helping farmers go through this. You started to say, what are some of the things that farmers can do? So I went to the USDA because they pay money to farmers for 159 different practices.
Wow.
If you jump through this hoop, you get, you know, so many dollars a lineal foot of fence. Mm-hmm. So now I'll give you some idea about what are those practices. So fencing to keep livestock away from streams. What's called a riparian buffer, where you have buffer strips next to waterways. And you just pull your farming back, I don't know, 50 feet. And so that takes 50 feet out of production. But it's a relatively small amount on a big farm, and the USDA is going to pay you money for taking that.
Less pollution into the waterway for that.
Less pollution in the waterway. You can have bioreactors. You can have a nutrient management plan, a grazing management plan. Just the very fact that most farmers, or I don't want to say most, there's a...
Is there a difference?
There's 2 million farmers in America,
right?
And they all behave differently.
Right.
And the larger the farm, interestingly, the better their environmental practice.
Ah,
dramatically better. And we often
talk about
The bigger guys are better, and they're better because they are. We often talk about farmers. As who are the early adopters.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've been working on conservation and trying to change the complexion of farming, we've been looking for who's ahead, who's behind, how far along the path of getting to a resilient agricultural system are we?
Yes.
And what we discover is that if you go to the larger farms, they are well down the path because they know that the nutrients that they dump in the Mississippi River, right, they paid for, and they're at scale. It makes more sense for them to pay attention to that.
Yeah. Are the Trust in Food? Are you guys working with? I believe you said the Nature Conservancy, the Walden Family, USDA, EPA. Are you guys working with all of these heavy hitters? I like that specifically on environmental, eco sustainability initiatives only? And if so, can you tell us about it? What is Think for Food? Trust in Food.
So yeah, let me give you a little background on Trust in Food. So first of all, Farm Journal, I gave you an idea about our footprint. Actually, our biggest reach anywhere is online. We see 15 million page views a month of people consuming our content.
Mostly about farming practices.
All about farming practices. Right.
Productivity,
all segments of farming. They come to us to figure out how to be better farmers, to keep up with trends, but mostly our stance is always, how are we going to help you be more successful? Like any trade.
Periodical.
Yeah. And we do nothing but farming. We were started by a farmer. I hate to give you too much background of ancient history, but we were started by a farmer in 1877 who said that all of the farming publications at that time were shills for snake oil salesmen. And he said, I want to have a publication that's on the side of the farmer. And we wear that every day.
Right.
And we have a unique position. We are so iconic and so well-read that we feel like we have a responsibility and an opportunity to move the needle in farming, and throughout our history, sort of part of our culture, is that we take on big issues that are challenging farming.
Right.
So, as an example, we had a huge impact in stopping what's called the widow's tax. The widow's tax, as you know, was if a guy died and you had to pay taxes on the transfer of the farm to his widow. And the fact is, you couldn't pay the taxes. So farmers are generally land rich. They have real estate asset that is substantial, but you can't pay that, but they have no cash. And so then they would pay the taxes and they would have lose the farm.
Yeah.
So we, I guess it's back in the 1970s, in 2 months got 300,000 farmers to send letters to Capitol Hill. Stop to that.
You guys have done incredible advocating on Farm Journal side. What about Trust in Food?
Right. So Trust in Food was started about 5 years ago, we started to realize that farming was going to go through a cataclysmic change, that the pressure from food companies, from consumers, from environmental demands was going to affect us like it affects every other industry, like the lighting industry or the auto industry, and a demand change.
Right.
And we felt like our responsibility is to guide farming through that change. And so we developed this Trust in Food group to do two things. One is to help farmers navigate that change and understand new technologies that are going to be asked of them and the pressures that are kind of unstoppable. So farmers are often risk averse.
Right.
Everybody would be risk averse when you make you have one payday a year. You make one bet in the spring, you get one chance. So
makes for really dry humor.
Makes for high risk. So we felt like we had to help drive that progress in agriculture. And at the same time, it's like two-way communication. Farmers have to listen better to what consumers are saying.
Right.
And at the same time, well, everybody in agriculture says, I wish consumers would better understand what we're doing.
Right.
And our position has been, agriculture has always said, let's try to preach to the public why what we do is good. And our stance has been, yes, some of what we do, much of what we do is good, and we should share it with the public. But we have to listen to the public, too. And
these are the practices,
changes.
Much of what you do, specifically
That's
the practices
right. So
that
now,
you're encouraging farmers to do, as well as the practices that they are doing, because even at the big level, though those guys get the bad rap, largely.
Some good stuff is happening, and we should do our job to find those stories and share those stories.
What's some of the good stuff?
Dramatic changes in nutrient use, GMOs. I mean, let's bring up the big one. GMOs have dramatically cut the chemical use in food production.
Right.
Dramatically. Like there's almost no insecticide being used in farming today. And
Incredible.
It used to be always.
Right.
And that's because we built insect resistance into the seed through hybridization. GMO is basically just hybridization mm-hmm. done in an accelerated way.
Right. And what are some of the bad things that you think are still going on that you guys are moving away from?
Well, so I told you we've often talked about how far along the curve of getting to a more resilient agriculture are we? And what we discovered is among the big farmers, maybe we're 50-60% of the way you want to get to. But among the middle range of farmers, we might be only 10% of the way.
Right.
There's a long list, cover crops. Cover crops are not a solution for every condition, but in
what is a cover 80, crop?
A cover crop means, so if you're growing corn, you grow corn in the summer, you plant it in May, you harvest it in October,
mm-hmm.
and then the land typically will lie fallow for the rest of the year. In October, you can plant radishes.
Ah, okay.
And the radishes will stay in the soil till the spring, and then you till the radishes in. And that prevents erosion. It keeps nutrients in the soil.
You don't harvest the radishes.
You
till them.
No, you till them.
Okay.
You till them. They're basically
food.
They're just a cover crop. There's
right.
no cash value to that crop. The value is the
keeps the soil good. Yeah.
It keeps soil good. It keeps soil in place. Stops erosion and it adds nutrients.
We have to take a quick commercial break and give a special shout out to Smile Radio, even though we are in DC at Switch and Board. SmileRadio.fm on the Instagram. Please check them out. Smile Radio is the host of a really cool set of podcasts that you all should check out, some on music and what's rad in disco funk, and some on great adventures. Rob Camacho, the surfer, has actually been recently featured. Please check them out. Smile Radio. SmileRadio.fm on the gram. And if you are ever on 24th and Lexington, please come check out our studio. It is right on the southeast corner there in the Smile to Go. Some of the best chicken and vegan options in the city. Shout out Smile Radio. We are back with Mooch Ruda from Trust in Food. I got that right on the eighth time, people. This is not my day job. And we are talking about what is good and bad in agriculture to understand a basis for a future conversation that we are going to have, potentially in the next episode, cliffhanger, about what the government is doing, what we are doing, and some of the environmental initiatives that you can get behind and support. because farming isn't bad. And that is our message today. So let's get right back into it. And in fact, Mitch, after this first, you know, 20 or 30 minutes or so that we've been talking, is there something that we've left out that you would like to note with respect to what either big agriculture is doing, what some of the stigmas are around big agriculture, what the little guy is doing, how people are catching up? We were just talking about cover crops. But what are some of, if anything, that we've missed the highlights?
Well, there's two things I'm thinking about. One is there's a couple of big categories of change that we haven't talked about. One is precision agriculture. So equipment is now remarkably different. It can read soil types. So depending on the soil type, and there's 30 different kinds of soil type, depending on the slope, depending on the where the sun is relative to that, depending on the climate, depending on where you are in the country,
right.
You should use different nutrients in different volumes.
Right.
Today's machines can take a map of the property, read the soil on a micro level, like inch by inch basis,
yeah.
And as you're driving a sprayer through a field,
adjust.
It is making it variable rate technology. It's called VRT, and it is, you know, it's double producing the whatever you're spraying, fertilizer over
right.
here, and it's not putting any over here because it doesn't need it over there.
Right.
So dramatic change in the use of chemicals.
And dramatic change in then the reduce of runoff, I would assume, too.
That's right.
Right.
Another one is biologics. So we talked a little bit about GMOs before, and GMOs are having a dramatic change in our use of chemicals. Biologics are a whole new class of chemicals that are, I guess you'd call them chemicals, but they're basically biological substances that apply nutrients, provide fungus protection, provide protection against things like nematodes, which are small organisms that damage roots of plants, all done with what are basically nutrient-enhancing, soil-enhancing organisms that actually work even after you apply and sort of create a change in the whole soil ecosystem. So there's dramatic changes there. You asked one other question before that I wanted to answer, which is our work with NGOs. So each of the major NGOs involved in the conservation space, Environmental Defense Fund, National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, Nature Conservancy, they are all aware that 65 or 70% of land in America is in agriculture.
Right.
If you want to fix and conserve land in America, you have to look at privately held land.
You got to talk to the farmers.
You have to talk to the farmers. And they each have different programs and are trying to help drive their agenda by driving an agenda that is positive to farmers.
Is this the basis then of Trust in Food?
This is the core of what we're doing. Is all of this work is being done by some of those organizations are heavy on research. Some of those organizations are heavy on handwork. They go into the farm and work with you and say, you know, if you put a pond over here,
right.
you could stop the water change the soil composition.
Right.
And they'll go in and they have scientists who will work hand by hand with farmers for free to go help them figure out how to do this right.
Right.
And so each one of them has a different objective in a different area about a different thing. We work with Ducks Unlimited on the Prairie Pothole area in northern,
So Trust in Food is dedicated to the preservation of the land and helping farmers through some of these NGOs who have dedicated their time, their science, their money to solving some of the larger problems.
We call it Trust in Food because we are really focused on rebuilding trust in the food system.
Right.
And that requires...
It's a little broken right now.
It's a little broken. And some of that break is because consumers have misconceptions about farming and what you don't know. It used to be... we used to be in an agrarian economy.
What are the three top misconceptions around big farming? Because I keep focusing on that because the little guy doesn't get that much heat.
Well, the first one is the word factory farm.
Right.
So there's almost no corporate what I think people have in their head about a factory farm.
The evil monocropping guy run by robots.
Okay, so there's a lot of monocropping, that's for sure, but it's all being done by families. And they're the same families that own the farms 100 years ago, and there are bigger farms than there were before, and generally that's because one family sold out to another family. But it's this guy and his cousin and his brother that are farming 30,000 acres in central Indiana, and it isn't some corporation that's publicly traded. So that's one. It's families that are trying to protect their own farm.
Why do they still monocrop, out of curiosity? Is it the most gas-efficient means of farming at this point?
Well, first of all, we have a need for, we have about 100 million acres of corn and about 100 million acres of soy.
And this
is mostly for livestock?
It
goes into three or four different places. About half of the corn and soy crop is for livestock. About a quarter is for food stuffs like high fructose corn syrup,
right.
Or
tortillas.
It's food ingredients,
right.
And then about 20% of the corn crop goes to ethanol.
Right. Okay.
So it's a wide variety of uses. We're a big exporter of both corn and soy, and we have a demand for 200 million acres of corn and soy. So I don't know when people talk about monocropping, now almost everybody switches between corn and soy. They add wheat, they add sorghum, there's other crops that they rotate in to keep the soil healthy.
Right.
But you got to put 100 million acres of corn somewhere.
Who is responsible for the degradation of the soil? Not to point fingers, it's just where is the root of the problem of us losing soil, 10 times faster than we can keep it healthier?
I don't know where that statistic came from, but I would not say that our soil is getting worse. I think our soil could be better. I think our pollution profile could be better. But I don't see that we're losing soil. I think that we're not making the most of it. We have not talked about carbon sequestration, and we probably should talk about that too.
We're getting there.
We're getting there. So farming has the ability to be the first major industry in America that's carbon positive.
Right.
And that could have a dramatic change both on climate change, because I'll tell you.
Because you can sequester in things.
Let me give you a specific example. So I was at the Department of Energy a couple months ago. They believe very much that that climate change is a threat. There are many scientists at the Department of Energy that are very well aware and can cite you statistics and are working hard on how to fix the problem. And the guy I was talking to is a scientist running a think tank there that is trying to figure out how to help agriculture get to make the economics work to improve soil carbon retention.
Is this the Stitchgrass guy?
Yeah, the Switchgrass guy.
Switchgrass.
And so what he said is that only a 30% improvement in carbon, in keeping carbon in the soil, the kind of thing that cover crops could have, yes, that kind of impact. If you did that nationwide, you would solve like 25% of our carbon usage. You would cut
U.S. wide, not just agro?
U.S. wide. Whew. That when they're thinking about how do we solve climate change in the future, and everybody's got statistics about how many, how much carbon we have to cut.
Yep.
And if everybody stopped driving forever altogether, that would cut 10% of our carbon use.
Right.
But if farms improved their carbon profile, they could cut 25% of our carbon usage. Essentially, cut it by storing carbon. It's not that they're using so much energy.
No, it's the sequestration, right?
It's the sequestration, but it has the net effect not completely solving the problem, but there's no better lever.
Right, so this takes us to Switchgrass.
And that takes us to Switchgrass, where the current value of, so there's several problems with the carbon market. So there is a carbon market that you can trade carbon credits. And
JetBlue announced that it was recently going to become the first carbon positive or neutral airline by using just that market. So it is active. Carbon offsets are traded today, right now, from big major corporations.
What DOE was saying was that there's no lack of demand for the carbon credits.
Right.
And the biggest problem is measurement, that you have to make sure that you really have the carbon
right.
sequestered. And it has to be measurable. And so he's busy trying to solve that problem. But he said today the value of that carbon benefit at farming could be $30, $40, $50 an acre. He believes that in the future, 5 years, a time horizon, that could rise to $200 to $300 an acre.
Wow.
That is a very interesting number because corn...
What is food production?
Corn makes about $300 an acre.
Oh, wow.
And so if you could make $300 an acre growing grass, which takes much less input and much less work...
Much less capital as well,
much
right?
less capital. You will see a dramatic change in the use of land because of these carbon credits.
Right. So who is going to be then responsible for the driving of those credits? Well, just to recap so we don't, you know, lose ourselves entirely because we've had so much information here. There are no real perpetrators. The soil is degrading worldwide for a number of different reasons outside of farming and agriculture. There are no real serious perpetrators. Some of the big guys are actually some of the best, but the use of chemicals, their runoffs have had tremendous and horrible environmental impacts, and there are still things that need to be fixed, which some very, very responsible and passionate folks are out there fixing. So we should trust in the USDA, we should trust in our farmers, we should support them, and we should learn more about where our food is growing so that we support potentially the right farmers, though we haven't drawn a lot of distinction here today, nor do I think we should. But just to note, you've stated that the people who are somewhat larger because of the market dynamics are the first to become carbon sensitive, to become eco-friendly because the economics, the dollars and the cents, make it worthwhile for them.
They can afford the big precision ag machines that I was telling you about,
right.
as an example.
Right. And what ultimately this industry is driving towards, because various parts of the government, from the USDA to the Department of Energy, have identified the fact that carbon sequestration is important and that farming can do a tremendous lift. You had mentioned 25% of U.S.'s total output could be taken care of by farmers. We are now seeing the rise of the carbon sequestration market for farmers themselves. And you have mentioned also there are certain crops like switchgrass, which potentially could store so much carbon efficiently. And there are other processes that you mentioned too, like cover crops, which was, again, the process of planting something after your major crop just to restore health to the soil. So sequester carbon, put nutrients back in the soil, then till it back in the soil. So really what we have here is an industry which is more ecologically conscious and forward thinking than I had previously thought. So I would give a mea culpa and an apology to farmers everywhere because I have been espousing things like agroforestry and regenerative farming without having heard a lot about the other side of this, where even though we've been trying to make farming more efficient for years and we've used chemicals to, in a large way, to the detriment of the earth, we are now in a cycle where we're shifting away from that, where GMOs and biologics, did you say they were called?
Yes, biologics.
Are reducing our need for things like insecticide and some of the more harmful chemicals. So what this kind of comes down to is, for me, in this particular section of our Better World episode, because I would like to get deep into carbon sequestration in the next one and different practices like agroforestry and what's working and what's not working. But what this comes down to me for me is that farming is doing the best that it can thus far. But I want to hear from you. What are some of the direct things that the consumer can do to either support some of these behaviors or change their own minds and re-educate themselves? So who should they support? What should they read? I didn't promise there wouldn't be loaded questions, Mitch.
Yeah, well, so you know, the support, you know, I'm having a little trouble with using with the
well, he's got to support all farmers. I get it.
No, it's not that. It's that there's two issues.
Are there so products that I should buy and not buy?
So first of all, most of the food products that are produced, so you can break farm food into, I guess, three categories: protein, fruits and vegetables,
right.
What we call specialty crops, and then row crops,
right?
Which are, and it, those three are behave a little bit differently. In the case of protein and row crops, most of the product is commoditized. And by commoditized, so there are farmers that are doing good behavior, there are farmers that are doing bad behavior. The corn winds up in the same bin.
Right. How do we support the good behavior?
So how do you behave? So, but that was what I was sort of stuttering about. Well, gee, what are you supposed to do when some of the corn is good and some of the corn is bad? Now, what's going to happen is the food companies are all, the entire world is changing. And every single company understands the pressure of the consumer. So General Mills cares a lot about trying to say that their product is being made in the most environmentally sensitive way. Right. I know the chief sustainability officer at General Mills, a very passionate woman, who is trying to change their sourcing at a dramatic level.
Shout out to General Mills.
They have a commitment to have millions of acres following prescriptions and being able to say that their product is being made from
this sustainable way.
Yeah, in the sustainable way. Now, they're still suffering from, in their case, wheat. A wheat supply that is mixed up.
Right.
And
they
will have some products that they will bring to market that they will say, this product is 100% made by sustainable practices.
Right.
And then this that would be a good thing for somebody who cares about it to say that's worth extra dollars. Now, P.S., sometimes that costs extra dollars.
Yes.
And one of the things I learned from the NGOs who are so passionate about what they're trying to accomplish is if they can't make the economics work for the farmer, they can't get the job done.
Right.
So similarly, a lot of things that people are asking farmers to do, well, if it costs them more money, okay, if I use less chemical or less nutrients, I'm going to get a lower yield. It's going to cost me money.
Right.
Now, if by doing that, I can produce a product, I can put it through a separate supply chain, give it to General Mills and say, General Mills, charge a premium. And then give that premium back to me, everything works.
Everybody wins.
Yep. Everybody wins. But the consumers, so one of the things consumers should think about is that sustainable behavior, sustainable products
cost more. We have to retrain the market.
We have to retrain the market. If that's a value system of yours, then don't make it the farmer's problem because the last 4 years have been basically a recession in farming.
Yep.
And they have
you just nailed it right there. The thing for our consumer to look at is don't make it the farmer's problem. Take a look at what the price is. Take a look at the sustainability chain. The large brands, even the small ones, are going to espouse, tout, brag about the fact that this thing was made well under whichever certification standard they used. And while I'm sure there are a multitude of these, it's not something that I want to get caught up in. But what we can do moving forward in getting towards the education is talk about where some of this information is published or is going to be published. Going to try and get you to commit to writing some guides while we're on air, Mitch. Watch me go. Look at me.
Well, there are smart labels on many products that give you details. So there's a smart label system that you can scan a label and it goes online and you get much more detail about how that product. If you care, you can go find that. I don't know if that's really the solution. Sometimes shorthand that we try to use as environmentally conscious consumers doesn't always work. I do sometimes buy organic products because I think they sometimes taste better, but I have no illusion that they are safer or that they use less chemicals. They use organic chemicals.
Well, okay.
And sometimes organic. I mean, I had a,
is a better one.
I had a farmer explain to me that he will not touch an organic pesticide because it's so caustic that he has to put gloves on and masking tape around where the gloves hit his jacket to make sure that stuff doesn't touch his skin. Where the synthetic insecticides are much safer.
Right.
And then we think, oh, it's organic, it's safe, it doesn't have chemicals. It isn't true. It's just organic.
Right. So some of the forward-facing information for consumers is readily available on Farm Journal? Or it still needs, some of this needs to be, more of this
I think the consumers buy from food processors. And ultimately, it is the food processor's responsibility to build the relationship with the consumer and to show off their value system. And that compact between the consumer and the food processor is what pressures the market.
Right.
So the more the consumer demands from the food company that they produce a product with happy cows on it, then the more that the food company will be demanding that up their supply chain.
We are going to take one brief commercial break before signing off this portion of our two-part episode with Mitch Ruda from Farm Journal. And we're going to thank our dear friends in Surf City, El Salvador. El Salvador is an incredibly safe paradise in Latin America, located on the Pacific Ocean, some of the best surf in Latin America, and is currently investing with their new government that took office last June in regions like El Zonte, 1 hour outside of San Salvador, their capital, in infrastructure, as well as in ecotourism. El Salvador is one of the largest leaders in the ecotourist movement, right behind Costa Rica or adjacent alongside Costa Rica and Panama. We highly recommend El Zonte and Puro Surf and the Palo Verde Hotel. Check them out, paloverdehotel.com, or check them out on the Instagram. If you guys DM us directly, we're at itsbetter.world. We will tell you not only some of the great details about what's going on in Surf City, why you should give a crap about ecotourism and agroforestry and what they're doing down there, but we've got discount codes. So please hit us up. Surf City, El Salvador, check them out. We are back with Mitch Ruda. Mitch, thank you very, very much for coming on the pod. We really, really appreciate this and look forward to the next portion of this episode when part two in our series, when we discuss what everybody's doing in carbon sequestration, how it's working, why it's working, why it's not working. I want to hear more about switchgrass, and I also would like to learn a little bit more about what Farm Journal is going to do in the future with consumers. We will be back, people, to finish off with Mitch. Thanks for listening to Better World.